Walla Wani, welcome to Earth Matters, environment social justice stories from Australia and around the world, produced at the studios of 3CR on Wurundjeri country in Naam, Melbourne, and broadcast across this continent via the Community Radio Network. I'm your show host, Beck Horridge, and I do pay respects to the elders, past, present, and emerging.
I got good mentors. I think the mentoring is the one of the most important thing, and supporting each other is another important thing. And we need to have stronger network among the like-minded or like-visioned organizations or individuals. I think that makes us successful.
That's Dr. Radha Vagal, the woman who started life caring for goats in a Nepalese village and became a leader in Nepal's international climate delegation. Today on Earth Matters, she'll be talking about her experiences at the climate negotiations, challenges women face in leadership roles within environmental sectors, and the necessity for systemic change to ensure their voices are heard. Radha was talking at the Victorian Women's Climate Congress. And later, we'll hear from Sophia Harderfelt from ActionAid Australia about the need for feminist systemic change.
Thank you. Currently, I'm representing Glen Eira City Council. I left that job before, but today I'm talking all about my journey from a safer girl to UNFCCC negotiations. I was born in a small village nestled in the mountains of Nepal, where I spent my early years as a safer girl. At the time, attending school seemed like an unattainable dream for girls from rural areas, but I was determined to pursue an education. In that time, I made primary school, but it was difficult to attend the secondary, but it was because it was far from my home. And many of the girls, they dropped out from the primary, and I was the one who could make the secondary. And how I made that is I made an agreement with my family, and I would continue with my daily chores, including cooking, cleaning, cutting grasses, and tending the goats in the morning, evening, and on holidays in exchange for my opportunity to attend the school. During my studies, I not only gained academic knowledge, but I also learned about the intricate relationship between nature and local communities, nature and women, as well as the various parts of discrimination, such as gender inequality that exist in the society. Despite those challenges, I graduated at top of my high school class and went to study forestry at university, which was sponsored by Nepal UK Community Forestry Project from the UK government. That's why it was possible. Otherwise, my parents, they were not able to afford me in that forestry education. And after completing my undergraduate degree, I worked as a forest ranger in remote areas at the foot of snow-capped mountains as one of the few female rangers. I faced surprise and skepticism from some members of the village, while others supported me. And some doubted my ability to perform the role, and I helped organize both men and women into forest user group and encouraging women to take leadership positions. Despite the government policies that mandated at least one-third female participation in those groups, local elites and foresters were not adhering those rules. And I advocated for policy compliance and encouraged women to actively participate in those groups and raise their voices. And women who were the primary gatherer of fuel, woods, water, and the medicinal herbs had a deeper understanding of the forest and nature than their male counterparts, and given their constant interaction with the environment. Then I was later promoted to conservation officer and assigned to one of the national parks, and becoming the first female conservation officer in Nepal, which is popularly known as park warden. At that time, there were no female park warden. However, working in a national park posed new challenges to me, and as it was an even more male-dominated field, and very few women in the service. And that time, where I was deputed as park warden, I was the only female one out of 147 males. And I faced a struggle in my leadership role, but worked tirelessly to promote people-centered park services. Local communities living around the park were often viewed as enemies of wildlife, And even though they were, in fact, victims of animal attack that damaged their homes, crops and livestock, and even caused injuries and fatalities. And I advocated for shift away from criminalizing local people, local communities in the name of conservation, and emphasizing the need to earn their trust through support and cooperation. And I worked to replicate the community forestry model in protected areas, empowering local communities to lead their groups and address their needs, such as fuel, water, and fodder. And the experience deepened my belief that including women in environmental conservation efforts is essential. And my journey took an exciting turn while I awarded an European scholarship to pursue a master's degree in biodiversity in Sweden. And the opportunity broadened my understanding of environmental science and expanded my vision towards achieving a gender equal society. Upon returning to Nepal, I worked as a planning officer in the Ministry of Forest, where I also had chance to become as a ministry gender focal point. And I observed that gender discrimination was prevalent not only in rural areas, but also within the workspace, including the ministry. And female staff members were often considered less capable than their male counterparts, and harassment, both verbal and physical, was a daily occurrence perpetuated by managers, colleagues, and even by the clients. And I spoke out against the injustice and advocated for the inclusion of anti-harassment policies. And in the meantime, Australia government offered me a PhD scholarship. I am so grateful to the Australian government for offering me Australia Award Scholarship to pursue my PhD at Monash University. Drawing on my background in both environmental conservation and gender equality, I focused my doctoral research on the inclusion of women in forest bureaucracy using feminist institutionalism as a theoretical framework. My research revealed the struggle for women faced under the weight of gender inequality, sexual harassment, and male dominance in the forestry and environmental sectors, whether they are farmers, academics, or bureaucrats in developing countries. I am deeply thankful to my supervisors, Professor Wendy Wright and Dr. Soma Pille, for their invaluable guidance and unwavering support throughout my PhD journey. And we co-authored a book as well during my PhD journey. And after completing my PhD, I sought to apply my research finding in practice to influence the policy I knew I had to raise to a higher level position. As a result, I became the first female joint secretary at the Ministry of Forest after open competition. And I later founded the Female Foresters Network, providing platform for women in forestry sector to unite and advocate for gender just policies and practice. And Suzy is the one of the member of that Female Forested Networks that we train her. She is the first cohort member. And there are some others, hundreds like her. And recognizing that climate change disproportionately impact women, I made my mission to bring more women into climate leadership. And I advocated for this agenda across government and society. Initially, I was denied the climate change portfolio, with colleagues asserting that women like me were not suited to participate in international climate negotiation. However, when the COVID-19 pandemic restricted the international travel, my male colleagues lost interest in the climate change division, thanks to COVID. Seizing this opportunity, I was appointed to the National Climate Change Focal Point for the Ministry of Forest and Nepal. This is for the UNFCCC. And having previously completed a course on negotiation skills for multilateral environmental agreements, I embraced the role and participated in various UNFCCC and Paris Agreement meetings, including those SBI and SAFSTA. In every meeting, I encouraged Nepalese women delegation, not only from the bureaucracy, but also from the civil society, indigenous peoples, and local communities to participate actively. In 2022, at the 26th Conference of Parties to UNFCCC, I had to the honor of leading the Nepalese delegation in the negotiations. And I was inspired by the support of many professional leaders in Nepal, including the British ambassador, Australian ambassador, EU ambassador, and country representative of UNDP. Fortunately, all of them were female. However, since COVID pandemic was over and in-person delegation increased, I was forced to leave a climate negotiator position. due to the belief within the male-dominated bureaucracy that only men could perform better in that role. Despite this, before leaving, I successfully submitted Nepal's gender responsive NDC second, which is still known as the one of the most gender responsive NDC in the world, and also submitted the National Adaptation Plan and helped to pass the National Gender and Climate Change Strategy for Nepal. These documents, which I developed in collaboration with a broad range of stakeholders, including women and indigenous peoples, will continue to drive my vision of gender-just climate action. And I am still continuing with UNFCCC, local communities and indigenous peoples facilitative working group member from least developed countries. And I just returned on 26th of March from my last meeting of that portfolio. And I'm working in grassroots level here in Australia as a biodiversity and climate adaptation specialist. And wherever I go, I do for gender. And I think it is difficult to do alone, but yeah, we can if we unite together. Thank you so much.
That was very amazing, Radha. Thank you very much. And Radha's also offered. So we're ready for a couple of questions. About that amazing history and experience and achievements.
Your area of work really interests me because I'm at a point where I feel a great conflict between putting my energies towards stopping coal, oil, all of that, and going, okay, the short term, we've kind of lost that battle and we need to get ready to save us from going into the, you know, the ravages of social change that climate change, climate crisis is going to bring down on our heads. It's clear that it's going to be monstrous. How do we get that started? Grassroots, definitely. We know our local communities best. Is there some template, some model? How can we start that right here, right now, in this amazing little village, really, of Castlemaine, where people are very well positively disposed towards each other, quite well networked. We already have people doing things like local food production. We have lots of latent community energy and active community energy. But how do we pull all that together and make it a movement that people can identify with coming into the area and going, right, you know, this is why I moved out of the city. I'm trying to downsize and trying to survive what is to come. Can you stay here and help us and be the local council officer, please? That would be great. I will run around and get your coffees and your pastries.
I think I need to tell from my experience, because I got good mentors. I think the mentoring is the one of the most important thing, and supporting each other is another important thing. And we need to have stronger network among the like-minded or like-visioned organizations or individuals. I think that makes us successful. That's my answer.
Dr. Radha Vagal talking about the importance of women's participation in climate action and the need for gender-responsive policies. You're listening to Earth Matters, broadcast nationally across this continent via the Community Radio Network. Now, more from Dr. Radha Vagal on the challenges women face in leadership roles within environmental sectors and the necessity for systemic change to ensure their voices are heard.
Thank you, Radha. That was such an inspiring presentation. My name's Jess. I was just wondering, from your lens as a climate adaptation specialist, I guess when we're talking about climate change in Australia, often we're thinking about energy or we're thinking about the extreme weather event, like the sudden onset impacts. And in terms of what you're seeing in Glenira, but I guess more broadly with other councils in Victoria, how seriously are we taking this kind of adaptation lens when we're looking at what the science is telling us about what the next 5, 10, 20 years is going to look like, but actually starting to address those things at the local level and connecting from that kind of from local government, state government, federal government, because we've really lagged on our adaptation plans from a national perspective, and there's not that much funding going in towards adaptation, but it's so critical, particularly from a systems perspective. And it sounds like you've done some amazing work. So I'm curious whether, you know, Glenira is seen as maybe even a leading council in this space, or how are we going?
Thank you. I think I don't have much experience regarding Glen Eira, but this is the new position that created for climate adaptation. And I think I'm a bit positive they are taking climate adaptation as a serious concern. And we have Glen Eira Emergency Climate Response Strategy for 2022 to 2025, which is terminated very soon. And we are starting to build another plan. And I'm already pushing why we have so much of emphasis on mitigation and why we don't have so little on adaptation. If we really want to do something for climate, we need to have the equal balance between mitigation and adaptation. And I'm hopeful that we can make it. And I'm so positive. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Radha.
And next, we'll hear from Sophie Harderfelt. She's the Policy and Research Manager at ActionAid Australia. She works with women in more than 40 countries across the world, targeting the intersection between women's rights and climate change.
Hi, everyone. Two amazing presentations to follow. Let's see if I can do them justice. I work for ActionAid International, which is a global women's rights organization. And we work with women in more than 40 countries across the world, really targeting the intersection between women's rights and climate change. And we do that for three reasons. Firstly, we recognize that there is a disproportionate impact that climate change has on women because of their existing inequalities and the impacts that then flow on impacts that that then has. Secondly, we recognize that women have a unique ability to respond to climate change and to respond to climate change, particularly at the local level in their communities, because of the knowledge that they have. And thirdly, because we know that the systems that underpin both gender inequality and climate change are the same systems. Whether we're talking about the patriarchy, neoliberalism, colonialism, institutionalized racism, these are the same systems that are holding women back and that are destroying our climate. And so when we think about the solutions, they need to be interconnected solutions and interconnected responses. And so our approach is really to try and bring together our approaches to gender equality and our approaches to climate change and really drive solutions that respond to both. I think Barbara set the scene for us pretty well this morning. You know, we're at a bleak time in history. We know that when we think about women's rights and gender equality, we're at a moment where there is a really coordinated pushback, you know, a rise in authoritarianism, a rise in far-right movements. And globally, we're seeing, you know, particularly a targeting of, you know, LGBTQIA plus rights, trans rights, SRHR, sexual and reproductive health rights. Women's rights is really under threat, and there's a need for us to really step up and push back. We're also seeing, you know, an economy that's increasingly concentrating wealth in the hands of the few, not the many. We're seeing that the impacts of that are particularly, you know, women of colour, people in the global south. Obviously, we're all here to talk about climate change and climate chaos that we're seeing is only escalating. So we're at this time where we really need to be thinking about alternative approaches, radical approaches. And if we think about what's the antidote to the world that we live in, intersexual feminism, I think, provides a really good alternative because it enables us to think about what the root causes are and to analyse those root causes and respond. It centres care. Caring for people, caring for country, caring for land. And it is focused on really working together, intersectionality, thinking about how we come together and work, you know, at all the levels that we can. So that's really something that at ActionAid we really try to center into all of the work that we do. Some practical things that we have learned through our work across many contexts to try and develop transformative approaches to gender and climate. The first is valuing women's knowledge. We did some foundational research a few years ago to really think about what's the best approach to gender transformative climate action. And something that came up in all of the interviews that we did was that there's a real disconnect between the way that women understand their environment, understand climate change, and scientific kind of technical talk and the way that we speak about climate. And so, you know, often we're talking across purposes. Women's knowledge isn't valued, scientific knowledge isn't understood, and we're not getting the best solutions. So really thinking about how we value women's knowledge alongside scientific knowledge and really value what women and what local people know about their environments, know about their communities. Driving Indigenous women-led solutions and alternatives, we work particularly with Indigenous women across the Pacific. Of course, we've heard about First Nations responses here in Australia, and that's really critical. What we see when women lead is that the groups that are generally excluded from the policymaking table, from, you know, the way that we think about our solutions, are all of a sudden centred. So women with disabilities, older women, younger women, women who have, you know, single mothers, women who are never at the policy table, that are often overlooked when we're developing our responses. If women are there, if they're central in the decision-making, if they're there leading the actual responses, then we get the solutions that we really need, and we get the targeted responses that bring everybody to the table. And then the final one is feminist systems change from the local to the global. And this is really about thinking all of the systems that are oppressing us, that are oppressing women, that are destroying the climate, they're interconnected systems. They're there at the local. It's the local patriarchal structures. They're there at the global level. We just did some research looking at global nationally determined contributions, national adaptation plans across the Asia Pacific region. Most of them are completely gender blind. You know, that national policy space is often very gender blind and not, you know, considering women at all. And then they're there at the global level in terms of, you know, the financial systems that we have, the economic structures that we center and that center our societies. So really thinking about how can we respond and shift the systems at each level and come together and work collaboratively. And this is really about, you know, the people power element of this change to really shift and restructure our societies globally, locally, nationally, at every point that we need to.
Thank you so much, Sophie, for sharing all of that experience with ActionAid. Do we have questions from the floor? Cecilia?
Thank you all for your amazing presentations. It's so inspiring today. I just wanted to expand on the systems change. And do you have a formula for how you think that process might evolve? Because when you say that, I think, yes. But then I think, what are the next steps? Is there any blueprint or pathway that we thought of in the women's movement for doing that?
I think that it's different in different contexts. So, you know, we do a lot of work I can talk about what we do in Vanuatu. So we do a lot of work with a network of 9,000 women leaders in Vanuatu who are really working around disaster response, disaster management. And for them, systems change is about A, being at the table, because they've never been at the table before. So really coming into the disaster response, disaster management space, owning that space, being there and being able to drive their solutions, that shifts the whole ecosystem in Vanuatu, and it has been shifting the whole ecosystem in Vanuatu about how we think about disasters and how they respond to disasters. And by doing that work, that has then enabled them to start to engage with local chiefs and local decision makers about bigger issues. So about issues of gender equality, women's engagement in local decision making, and to actually go into spaces that previously they would never have the ability to enter. So, you know, by coming in with a particular focus on disaster management, they're able to then think about how they shift wider social structures. And we've had some of those women then start to engage in regional Pacific decision-making about climate. Some of them have attended the climate COP. So one kind of project has enabled them to start to think about systems change at lots of different levels. And that's kind of just one community, one country. So I think that there's a localized approach, but then we do need to think about how we, you know, how we're building a collective agenda, I guess, so that we're all working towards the same systems change in our local context, but it's joined up to have, you know, that global impact.
We've got another question down the back.
I am really concerned as we talk about systems change and we talk about getting women into the system to change the system. In my own experience, what do we do? How do we support women not to be captured by the system? Because we watch that happen every day in our own system. And I'm really interested in what you've been able to do, because I'm very inspired by what you're doing. How we can support women not to be captured.
It's a very good question. I'm not sure I have the answer. I mean, I think that bringing a feminist analysis is really important because that is about us constantly thinking, you know, when we're coming into this work and when we're coming into these spaces, thinking, what is the structural change that we actually have to make? So we're not, you know, it's not just a women, you know, bring women in approach. And that's kind of often the start, and it is important to get women in. But if we're just going to have women at the table and they're going to say the same things, well, then, you know, we're not getting the outcomes that we want. So I think that bringing that feminist analysis and really thinking about what is the change that we know that we need to make is so critical. Doing that is really hard. Yeah, and that's what we're doing. That's why we're here.
That was Sophia Harderfelt talking up the next steps for feminist climate action, like fostering stronger networks among women leaders and advocating for balanced approaches to climate mitigation and adaptation strategies. Thank you again so much to the Women's Climate Congress for collaborating to make This Earth Matters. And thank you to all the speakers and supporters of Earth Matters. And there are more recordings from the Women's Climate Congress. Check it out online, Women's Climate Congress. You've been listening to Earth Matters, Community Radio's National Environment Justice Program. If you missed any of today's show, you can find our podcasts at 3cr.org.au/Earth Matters. Or if you're listening via iTunes or any other podcasting service, why not rate us and leave us a review and help spread the word. Earth Matters would like to thank the Community Broadcasting Foundation for their financial support and the Community Radio Network for getting the program out to you. Earth Matters is produced in the studios of 3CR. On Wurundjeri country. If you'd like to get in contact, you can send us an email at earthmatters3cr@gmail.com or go to our Facebook page. I hope you can tune in next time for one more Earth Matters. Thank you.